So I will talk about work that I've done in, at ETH Zurich in the group where I did my PhD, and now recently I moved to Harvard, so in another group, but that's not going to be the topic of today's talk. What I will talk about is how we make a quantum gas crystallize. And this is something that has been, is basically placed within the context of quantum simulations, which is one of the major motivations of ultra-cool atoms. And mostly when you talk about quantum simulations, and in particular for ultra-cool atoms, what you think about is a simulation of something like that. So we are interested in some kind of material that is mostly very complicated to understand. And so it's it's complicated to understand. It's also complicated to observe because it's very, very small and very fast time scale. So here the electron motion that determines now the conductivity properties of this material is very fast, and also it happens at a length scale that's very hard to observe. And what we do in ultra-cool atoms is instead of that, we replace this, we take the basic structure of that. By generating a potential that mimics the potential that the ions in the solid generate. And we generate this here by laser light, and on top of that now we put atoms, and these atoms now can tunnel around, they can hop, and they can also interact if they are on the same side, and that mimics very much the motion of the electrons in the real solid. Turns out you can actually simulate quite a number of Hamiltonians for that, that can involve interactions, that can involve artificial magnetic fields, local offsets of the potential, and the best thing of all is that our readout properties are, our readout capabilities are really, really good. So we can not only manipulate many, many properties of this artificial material, but we can also observe it. And we can observe it because our length scales are much larger, so we are now talking about optical lattice constants, or lattice constants that are determined by optical wavelengths. And so they're now micrometer large instead of fractions of nanometers. And so that also means that we can use optical means to actually observe the atoms. So what you see here is actually a picture, and each of these small points here corresponds to one atom that moves on this lattice potential, on this artificial, in this artificial material. And now what we can do is we can take a snapshot of the atoms, we can actually can manipulate it, so we can project arbitrary potentials on that and change by that the way the electrons, or the atoms here actually can move. So we can do some fun stuff, but we can also do very useful things, for example here one-dimensional lattice. And now the atoms are actually restricted in this, so we play the box around this, and then now the atoms are restricted in this one dimension. And then we can start and let this many-body state evolve, and with this high control of every individual atom, the position of every individual atom, we can measure very high order correlation functions, very, very complicated correlators, or entanglement entropy, so many different quantities. This is very exciting. This field of quantum simulation, and this is where I do my postdoc at the moment. But there are also other exciting things, and this is actually something that I worked in a PhD. So what we did here was going beyond that, so in some sense beyond of that, because what we do here is we only look at the electrons. But what we don't take into account is actually this lattice. The lattice is something static here. This lattice potential is imposed by laser light, and therefore it's out of the dynamics. A very interesting question is what happens actually, how can I end up at this lattice? So here, this lattice is just, I impose the lattice constant, I will impose the lattice structure. I will not be able to see, for example, phonons or any other kind of dynamics. I also will not observe any structural phase transition where atoms reassemble them in a different pattern. It's impossible because all is generated by laser light and therefore they are put in by hand. This is a consequence of the atom of the fact that the atomic interactions are short range. They're so short range that they're actually contact interactions. That means that the range of the potential is very, very small compared to any interparticle distance. And therefore the atoms only see each other when they actually collide. That's not nature, as you know. Nature is long range, and this means that many phenomena can only be observed if we have atoms that are long range interacting. For example, proteins that fold in some certain way, or some also actually, if electrons are long-range interacting, you can see some pattern formation on top of a lattice, and of course like normal structures, like a structure phase transition from a solid to a fluid, something like this. All these kind of things are not accessible here. And the reason is, as I mentioned, that this potential is just a short range. Yeah, we have the typical interparticular distance, which would be like somewhere down the wall, and here there's the potential. And therefore, for normal hyperbolic atoms, in the way we usually use them, this is not accessible. One key question, actually, or one of the motivations why hyperbolic atoms wanted to look at long-range interactions and structural phase transitions in with hyperbolic atoms is that we, for free, get already superfluidity. Right? Or Bose-Einstein condensates are described by one giant matter wave with a coherent wave function. And now, if you could make this this a superfluid crystallize, then what we will get is the coexistence of superfluidity and the crystallization. And this has been a very, very old question. So we started actually with superfluid helium when this was discovered, and then people asked the question: can actually also solid have something similar for a solid? So basically, the question is, can a solid be at the same time superfluid? Can it have some kind of coherent wave function that has a local, that has a periodic density modulation on top of it? And this is what's called a super solid, and has been, a subject of intense research for decades. It boils down to this question: if I can have, this is a very famous picture of the helium superfluid, if this symmetry of the superfluidity, if this can be broken at the same time as the translational symmetry. The most famous work was done here at UBS at Penn State University in the group of Chan, and what they did, they put some helium, a small bucket here, and then they measured the eigenfrequency of that by exciting it, and if the resonance frequency changed, they knew that some part of the helium didn't participate in the rotation anymore, and therefore the moment of inertia would change, and that would have been an indication of having a solid that actually flows, right? And that flows in a superfluid way. And that was actually a really, really nice indication that it works, because you can see here this is clearly deviates from a flat curve. And that's, for eight years, people were very, very excited about this, and they were believed that it worked. So you might guess why I put the second citation here. After 8 years, people figured out that this is a very subtle surface effect, but it has nothing to do with supersolidity. So this was a very sad moment for the entire supersolid community. What happened in the meantime was that ultracold atoms developed more and more tools to actually go into the direction of long-range interactions, to have atoms that interact over much longer ranges than what I mentioned previously. One of these platforms are heteronuclear molecules, where you have two different kind of atoms that form a molecule, and they have different electronegativity, so they have a bit more of the electronic monopoly of the two, that creates a common electric dipole, and that lets them interact. And actually, one of our organizers, Sebastian Will, is one of the major drivers of this field at the moment, building a new experiment, where they wanted to study exactly these molecules and also explore the long-range interactions between them. Another approach are some magnetic dipoles, and it turns out this is very nice. They're not strong enough to actually see these effects, because the interactions, even for the strongest ones that one has explored so far, are not sufficient to see a pattern formation. One can see some of these effects, some dipolar interactions, but one cannot see a pattern formation in this, not yet at least. Maybe one finds other parameter regions in the future. The third big community in ultracold gas atoms are Rydberg atoms, where the outermost electron is promoted to a very high valence state, and therefore the dipole moment of this atom, of the Rydberg atom, is much stronger, and therefore all the dipole interactions are so strong that true distant atoms can still interact. But now the lifetimes here are not sufficiently long to actually see motion of Rydberg atoms, and therefore the structural phase transition. One can see effects of dipole interactions, but lifetimes are not strong enough so far. So what we use here is the fourth approach, and this is one where we use light to mediate these interactions between different atoms. So it's the basic principle is very simple. We shine in laser light, and this is very, very far away from any atomic resonance. And this means that the atoms scatter this photon off resonantly, and the second atom actually can see that this photon, and this means they effectively have exchanged this photon, so there is an interaction between these two atoms. This is a very basic mechanism. Now, if I would just do this in free space, it turns out this is not sufficient. It would be a very, very weak interaction, so I have to enhance this interaction, and the way we do this is by putting these atoms in an optical cavity, it's a Fermi-Perot cavity, to mirrors next to each other, and this means that once the light has been scattered off, once the photon has been scattered off one atom, it circulates many, many times until it can hit another atom
the very first time.
So we got a stupid question. When you're talking about atoms here,
yes.
Are you talking about legitimately like this microscopic atoms of your Bose-Einstein condensate or whatever mimics the atom size?
So these are actual atoms.
These are atoms.
These atoms, they are all part of the one big Bose-Einstein condensate. I'll mention this in a moment, how exactly it looks like. But this is actually, so I think the comment is a very good one, because what I talk here about actually atoms, but of course this atom picture breaks down in the sense that we actually have a superfluid, so one coherent many-body wave function, right? In that sense, this picture is a bit misleading, but it's still very useful to understand the microscopic mechanisms. So this interaction is very nice because it's tunable. We are not relying on some atoms that have these kind of interaction properties, and then that's what they are. We can now use the light here in the way we would like to have the interactions and shape these interactions angle. For example, we can change the scale. So we can say, where should this minimum lie of the Lennard-Jones type potential? Where should this be? By just using a different wavelength, because now the interaction scale is set by the optical wavelength that we use. And we have some freedom of choosing different wavelengths, and therefore tuning this lattice constant. Another thing that we can change is the strength by changing the atom light coupling. This could be, for example, the number of photons that we inject here, or the coupling of the atoms to the cavity. There are different ways of doing this, but we can actually tune this over a unit range. And the third thing, which is a bit more involved, we're working a lot about this, and this is basically the main topic of this talk, changing also the shape of that. So, and this is by changing the involved scattering processes. You can see here that there's a photon scattered here, and this can basically only scatter into the cavity or out. But maybe I can change this by the involved light nodes, so that actually momentum, this will then change the number of momentum states that are involved in this interaction, and therefore by basically build up in a bottom-up approach the interaction potential in reciprocal space instead of in real space as we usually think about this. So you see that we have some control over this, and we aim at increasing this control further and further. The setup in which we did all the measurements that I will show you in this presentation looks like this. And you can see here there's a copper platform, and this platform is it's not a platform because it allows us to exchange this kind of stuff. And the center you see actually are all these formulas here. The gels are this what it looks like, the same formulas. And this is where the magic happens. In the middle, we place a Bose-Einstein condensate, and then we have two cross cavities. So you can see it's already an advantage over the previous. What I told you earlier, that we would have one cavity, we have actually two cavity modes. And we can play quite a bit with that. You can see the length scale, it's rather small, but not extremely small, and that allows us actually to quite conveniently place a Bose-Einstein condensate in the center. What you see here is two laser beams. These laser beams, they create an attractive potential, so at the end, what we obtain is a harmonic trap here in the center. It's a very shallow harmonic trap, such that it doesn't harm any of the other dynamics, but it's still sufficient to keep the atoms in place. These are some typical numbers that you know what are the regimes in which we are working. We have around 200 atoms. We use rubidium-87. That really doesn't matter at all which kind of atoms we use, it just has to be bosons. And rubidium is, as some of you might know, is like one of the most convenient ones for ultra-thin atoms because it is hydrogen-like. It only has one valence electron that makes it very convenient to work with. So we produce these Bose-Einstein condensates every 7 seconds, and after the cycle, we measure the atoms where they are, the momentum distribution. I will show you later how exactly this works, and then the whole thing restarts. So each time there's a destructive measurement, and at the end of the cycle, we restart the whole thing and do a copy of that and work with many of these different copies.
What is convergibility?
Yeah, I'll mention these now. So the atom dynamics now are, I mentioned earlier that we have different matrix scales, different type scales, so these are our scales now, and they're quite convenient. The atomic dynamics are now governed by the lattice constant, which gives us in this case it's related to the recoil energy of one single photon. So this is typically on the order of a few kilohertz. The photon dynamics is much faster. The photon dynamics is set by how long does a photon stay in the cavity until it exits the cavity. And this basically gives us, and this is on a much more faster time scale than the atom dynamics, and therefore we can actually think of the photons creating like a breast interaction because it's a magma class of time scale, you can separate the time scales and think, only think about the atomic motion without thinking of the actual photon elements. And this is, at least the order of magnitude faster. The lattice constant, as I mentioned, that is on the order of optical wavelengths, so this is around micrometers. And now the coercivity tells me how many times can a photon interact with another atom before I lose it. So the field of gravity is I want to be larger than one per atom. For a single atom, it would be larger than one to make sure that I have actually coherent dynamics inside. Now this is actually at 10, and together with that, there's another factor of n actually, because I have so many atoms, this is basically the boson enhancement factor. So that means I'm very much in a coherent regime here, and I don't need to think about dissipation of the cavity in the dominant process, but that's not the case.
Can you say again what's kilohertz, meaning atom dynamics, what do you mean by that?
I mean that the motion of the atoms is on the order of kilohertz. So this is
the trapping frequency or something like that?
The trapping frequency is very much a shadow. It's not about the dynamics of the interactions at which atoms can move there, due to the interactions.
Or some sort of mean free time. Mean free time, something like that.
No, it's not about interactions, it's not about collisions. It's about the time scale at which atoms can move due to the interactions. It's not the collision time of two atoms. It's the motional dynamics of the atoms. So if I have a photon, if I have a scattering photon of a photon, how fast does the atom get due to the collisions?
G for the cavity parameter.
The G in this case is megahertz, but it's not the only thing that would matter here. What matters is the coercivity. The G is just an on-resonance, so it's just an on-resonance quantity.
I'm just trying to understand what you are meaning about the atom dynamics.
It's the motional time scale of the atoms. So how fast do atoms move? They move within milliseconds from one lattice to the next, for example. It's like, for example, in a lattice you would say the bandwidth, that would be like the typical energy scale there for the motion, right?
Something like the hopping of the lattice.
Now it won't be still as a continuous gas, right? But in a lattice the typical energy scale would be the hopping. And here once we would have a pattern here, actually this would be the hopping.
So can I think of it as a proxy for the temperature of these atoms?
The temperature is zero. Okay. It's all atoms at zero temperature. We have a macroscopic correlation of the ground state, the Boolean equivalent
state. So sort of like the velocity of the atoms once they get hit by a photon or something, right?
You can also think of, the recoil energy or recoil velocity is just basically h bar times the lattice momentum, right? That's the momentum scale. So it's set by the length of the lattice or the photon recoil at different ways. Did that become somewhat clear? Some more, if you can.
Can you say again why we can think of it as a closed quantum system?
It's not a closed quantum system, but we can think about the interactions between two atoms happen on a faster time scale than the photon dynamics. So the point is basically that if I send a photon into the cavity, through the scattering process, it will interact with another atom before it actually loses, before it exits the cavity. And therefore, there's actually one. The interaction between two atoms is done in the total loss process. That's the probability larger one. Yes. So the lab in this is very similar before. So we have two tables. We use one table to prepare all the laser light, and then we dive into optical fibers to the actual experiment table over there. There's a vacuum chamber, and inside of all vacuum chambers is present. So we prepare to the Einstein condensate, different cooling methods, and then we get here from. Good. So much for the kind of motivation and introduction. Now, in the remainder of the presentation, I would like to show you three different kinds of crystals that we can generate with the setup. The first one is a lattice supersolid, the second one is a more regular supersolid, as I presented before, and the third one is solid Ebersch point order. So let's start with the lattice supersolid. You can see that they are always pinked by their symmetry properties, and the lattice supersolid is one of the simplest symmetry properties, and therefore that's the best to start with. And it also gives me another opportunity to actually explain these photon-photon interactions, or these photon-induced interactions a bit further. Let me start with the setup. So here's a cartoon of this of these two optical cavities in which we couple the Einstein condensate. And so for the moment, we will just look at one single cavity. And the spark second one, we can do this by tuning the resonance frequency of the second cavity so far away that the atoms, that neither the atoms nor any large field existence. So for it's, at the moment, it's like the second one will not be there. So now what happens in here is that once you shine in light along this direction, this is basically that light field goes from the both up and down, so it's a standing wave. You have two laser beams from here and from the top. That creates a standing wave related here. And what happens in there is now we get again these scattering photons that I mentioned before. So we have photons that can be scattered and by the different atoms, effectively exchanged by two atoms. Now there are a number of scattering causes that are involved into this in the system now. Let's start with the center. So this one is the BC at zero momentum. It's here momentum in the x and y direction. And if I start with an atom in the Bose-Einstein condensate, well, what it can do is it can scatter a photon that comes from below, and then scatter it, for example, so if I take a photon that will travel up here, and I scatter it in, to the lower right in the cavity mode, what I get a photon momentum kick up because I absorbed it there, and then to the upper left because I kicked it into this cavity. This means that effectively I have a two photon process from the ground state here and to the signal to state here. Did everybody follow that? I will do it for one more. If I would instead, for example, emit it to the upper left, so I take a photon from this beam here, I emit it to the upper left, then I get again a kick up, and then a kick to the lower right, which brings me from here up and then here. And now I can do the same with the opposite direction by first starting with the photon from the top. And once I would have photons in the cavity, I can also do the inverse and take a photon from the cavity and scatter it into one of these two beams. And this would be the dashed lines. So I have basically these four different momentum states that are coupled now to the ground state by two photon processes involving one of these two laser beams and the cavity mode. Since these two laser beams here, so we, since they inject fairly good photons into the system, we call it a pump, a transverse pump, because it's transverse to the cavity. So from now on, I will often call it the transverse pump, and we just call it that. Two beams will be called like one beam, the one standing edge. So now we see that we have these kind of momentum processes. We can also describe the system of these kind of interactions in a Hamiltonian. You can see here A1 are the photon excitations in the cavity. Omega plus is would be the energy of associated to this and this momentum state. You can see that they're a bit further away from the zero, and therefore their energy is a bit higher. And omega minus would be plus two, so their energy is a bit smaller. And then you also have the interaction here, so you can basically C naught is a photon, is an atom from the ground set, so from the BC. We annihilate this one, and we create one, for example, in the C plus mode, so in one of these two momentum states, and at the same time, we can either create or annihilate a photon in the cavity by either scattering into the cavity at this process or scattering out of the cavity. So these are the elementary interactions, and it's a very microscopic picture of these interactions. And what happens now in the system is that we basically have a competition of these interactions with the kinetic energy associated to each interaction. So this means for weak interactions, so for weak coupling lambda, everything will stay the same, good way it is, but if I have very strong interactions, very strong coupling parameter lambda, at some point I will overcome this kinetic energy. And so these ones here, the momentum models are determined by the geometry, right? These are determined by the recall energies that we have here. Whereas the coupling parameter lambda here, this one I can actually tune by the power of this transverse pump beam. So the number of photons that I want to inject into the system. So this allows me to tune this through this interaction. And at some point, if I do this strong enough, then it's going to overcome it, and I expect to have well scattered photons into the cavity.
N is the number of rubidium atoms, or?
Exactly, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. And the other one is the energy of one photon in the cavity. Yeah.
Yes? I'm confused with something. Why is the atom more likely to radiate back into the cavity rather than in some other direction?
Basically, this is now the strong happening of the cavity. So if I would put these tumors here and put an atom in the center, it's much more likely to eject the photon into the cavity mode rather than anywhere else. Basically you amplify this particular vacuum mode by putting the mirrors here. So the coupling to the cavity is much stronger than to any other mode that is in free space. Just because you have basically an enhancement of it. So if there was an effect default in this direction, since this would come back, I have a constructive interference of all the scatterings, and therefore this is much higher. So it's a Purcell factor.
You're also a resonance problem, no?
They're close to, so this light here is very close to the resonance of the cavity, exactly. And actually the difference in energy between this light and the cavity mode is exactly this energy of organ in the rotating frame of the transit pump. Now we can see that the semicircle actually has a symmetry. And the symmetry is related to it's a Faraday symmetry of the light field and at the same time also the excited momentum modes. So basically you can see that if I would here those cancels here, cancels here, cancels and here, since they always come in pairs, it's also cancelled. So the Hamiltonian stays invariant under this transformation. And what it means is that the light field changes its phase. And the photon, and also the relative phase of the ground state, the Bose-Einstein condensate, and these excited momentum states also changes by pi. And what it means in real space is that this interference here, so this pattern, changes by just half of this constant. So let me explain this maybe in a different picture. All these scattering processes that so far we have only looked at momentum space. If we look in real space, I actually can also think of scattering amplitudes that interfere constructively or destructively. So, for example, if I now have the homogeneous Bose-Einstein condensate, and now I would have two atoms that are somewhere in between, all the scattering amplitudes will cancel because it's just homogeneously distributed. But now, once I have an incoming photon, and I would have, for example, two atoms lambda apart, but like one wavelength apart, well, then the scattering amplitudes they act constructively, and I will get scattering into the cavity. And now, since they are lambda apart, so lambda apart means constructive interference of the scattering amplitudes, whereas the cavity mode itself has a lambda half periodicity, so half the wavelength. So I have actually two different places where how the atoms can sit there. Either they're sitting on the even sides or on the odd sides. Maybe, should I elaborate a bit more there? Or is it clear? I think that if nobody said anything, I should maybe tell you a bit better. So if I actually, let's assume the cavity, for example, is at the moment it's just horizontal. And now if I would have the cavity around here, this is kind of the boundary condition right here, the theta must be zero. This is the cavity mode. And now if I would inject light from here and from here, an atom that would sit here can scatter into the cavity, but if there's a second atom sitting here, well, these two scattering amplitudes interfere destructively, therefore there will not be any scattering into the cavity. However, if the second atom sits here, these two scattering amplitudes act constructively because they're in phase with respect to the cavity axis, and therefore it's going to be enhanced to scatter into the cavity. So the way how I can think about it is that if the coupling is low, so if this transit pump is very weak initially, well, since the atoms are all homogeneously distributed, nothing will happen. But any fluctuation on the lambda energy fluctuation will basically create that there are 100,000 atoms homogeneously distributed, but a few of them will be lambda, one way through the park, and therefore they will trigger now the system, this runaway process. They start scattering light into the cavity. This means that I would have a potential that actually supports atoms being lambda apart. This will then make even more atoms scatter photons into the cavity, and this will then, we get a runaway process that creates a density modulation, so it creates many more atoms being lambda apart. And now if I would look at the Fourier transform of that, you can see that this is just, so one wavelength apart is just the same as the momentum modes that we saw earlier in the scattering picture. So these two features are actually just equivalent to the Newland momentum space. And also here, the symmetry here is basically if these atoms are sitting here or here, so even on the outside. And this is just a 2D representation of what I've shown here in one dimension. If I now don't take into account that actually, but I basically look at the rest atom interactions, I can derive an effective interaction potential between two atoms that they would see inside the cavity. And you can see that the relative position of two atoms it's not quite a balanced potential, but we get a minimum at one number at one wavelength. And that means that this is exactly what we wanted to have. We wanted to have a potential that shows a minimum at a distance that is on the order of the interparticular distance. And in our situation, the interparticular distance is on the order of optical wavelength, and therefore we exactly expect to see a crystallization of the system. Now, then you can see that this it's periodic, so there will be more minima and here as well. So this potential extends over the whole cloud because no matter where the second atom sits inside the cavity, it will always see the photons, and therefore it's a global interaction. It doesn't have a single minimum. The second part that is associated to this interaction, which is the center of mass movement, this is restricted now to two different positions per wavelength. And the reason for that is exactly the symmetry, right? I mean, I can sit either here or here, but I will never have two atoms sitting here and here because they would sit at the nodes of the electric field, and therefore they will never be able to scatter light. So there are only two different positions at which this crystal can form, and therefore it's a Z2 symmetry, and this is exactly the same as the Hamiltonian symmetry, this one here. Now let's do the experiment, the actual experiment. So what we can do is we have two different observables with which you can detect if the atoms are in a homogeneous distributed state or if there's actually a density modulation that formed. The first observable is looking at the photons exiting the cavity. So the cavity is not perfect, so eventually photons will leak from the cavity, and from the number of photons that are ejected, we can infer the mean intra-cavity photon number. So this is in a coherent state, and so therefore we can actually indirectly or in real time see in which state the photon field is. The second observable that we have is the momentum distribution of the atom. So what we do is we can, our shadow track, we can switch it off, and by that the atoms can expand, and when they expand, since they are in a supercooled state, you basically get a matter wave interference, and after a long time of flight, these atoms the density distribution will actually be the momentum distribution that was before the expansion inside the trap. So we have access to the momentum distribution by ejecting the atoms at the end of the experiment, and we can actually also see the light fields. And light fields you can see is in real time. So potentially during the measurement, we can always detect the photons, whereas we can only once let the atoms expand and image them. So the way you observe them is what you see here is in a shadow. So basically we shine in on the axis perpendicular to the board. We shine in a resonant laser beam, and what we do behind that, we see that we can observe the shadow that is cast from the atoms. And so this basically means that where it's black here, there's no light, where it's white, there's still light, the light that we sent in. And by that, we can directly see what's the density. And since we do this after some time of flight, we see the density that actually corresponds to the momentum distribution inside the harmonic trap. So, what's going on? Okay, there we are. That's the actual experiment. We start with the Bose-Einstein condensate inside the cavity, and now what we do is we, over time, ramp up the time field along this direction, and as it gets stronger and stronger, first we see nothing happens, and then here, at some point, we hit the critical point, and we see photons in the cavity rising very fast. And so the photon number in the cavity changes drastically at the critical point. We can describe this as since it's a Z2 symmetry breaking, this is basically the same as a Z2. Effective Landau potential, first we have a parabola, and at a critical point we develop two different minima, and our system by itself chooses one of the two minima. But since the two minima correspond to a positive or negative phase of the field, so you remember there was this symmetry of A versus minus A of the photon field, we can't detect this because we only detect photon numbers, but on our detector we only see a peak of the photon. We can't see the sine of alpha. So we don't know if we were this or this minimum, but still we see that we have a non-zero light field in the cavity. Yes?
Can you get critical exponents?
Yes, yeah. I will not elaborate on this, but for all the different phases that I present today, you can actually also look at the critical behavior and look at the factor ratings. You can see correlations, you can actually see the divergence of the time scale close to the critical point, and all these kinds of things. That's the beauty of having this real time observable, where you can actually see the fluctuations in real time of the system. So now, since the atoms are, you see these very nice momentum peak here, momentum peaks. Let me briefly explain what they are and why they are so nice. So the center is the ground set of the Bose-Einstein set, and now these four here, they correspond exactly to the scattering processes that I've shown earlier, right? The up scattering and so on. These are these four. Additionally, we get also this one and this one, and these ones are at two photon momenta up or down. And so this corresponds to the standing wave of the transverse pump, but that's not the physics we are interested in, but it also doesn't harm us. The interesting part are these four here, which are which tell us that we actually enter the self-organized crystalline state.
Okay, for a stupid question, but can I think of that as the reciprocal lattice sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Can I interpret that picture as the reciprocal lattice?
Yes,
some spatial modulation as well. And,
exactly. It's exactly the reciprocal lattice. It's just the photon scattering picture is just a different way of thinking of that. It's different ways. And now since this one now broke is a true symmetry but maintains its coherence, so it's what's considered a lattice supersolid. So you partially enclose the lattice, but you don't fully enclose it. So there's still some symmetry breaking of a structural phase transition, but it's not continuous symmetry that is broken by just a discrete one. Now, the next crystal that I would like to show you is the V1 supersolid. So this is now one where we actually can promote this discrete symmetry to a continuous symmetry. So how does this work? Well, you might guess it works because we induce a second cavity. With a single cavity, we will always have these kind of boundary positions where we can sit either here or here, but we will not have any other position where it's crystal before. Now, if I have a second cavity, well, what I can do is I can basically place the second cavity. So this is not the diffuser, this is not a process pump, and this is the second cavity. And now what I do is that, that's a bit complicated. I think this doesn't work so nicely. The point that I want to make is that I now overlap the second cavity mode in a way that it's always out of phase with the first one. So basically, the second cavity mode would be like this. And this now, if I now have an equal coupling to one cavity and the same coupling to the other cavity, the overall coupling to both cavities together is independent of the position. Sometimes it will couple more strongly to the first cavity, sometimes more strongly to the second cavity, but it will always have the same overall coupling to light. And therefore, it doesn't matter where this density modulation forms, it's always energetically equivalent. And what this means for the interaction potential is basically that this center of mass term here, once I switch on the second cavity, it vanishes. It vanishes exactly if the coupling to both of the two cavities is identical, and if I have a more strongly one of two cavities, well, there's still a residual modulation in the cavity. So for the moment, we will consider the situation where we couple identically to both cavities, and therefore the center of mass term vanishes, and the only thing that remains is the relative position between the atoms, so we still have our minimum at a distance determined by the wave. The interesting thing is now that basically these two cavities, they cancel the boundary conditions of each other, and we are left over with something where we don't have a boundary condition of the cavity anymore. I can also look at this again in the terms of momentum processes. You see, it's a bit more complicated, but it's not more than just adding the previous momentum scheduling process. We mirror it, and the other ones are just the new momentum nodes that are mirrored with respect to the first form. The Hamiltonian is also just the sum of the two cavities. So we have now the same as before, but now everything with an index I. And this also means that as soon as these perfectors are the same, and if the delta I, so delta 1, delta 2 is the same, that means that the resonance frequencies of these two cavities are the same, the scattering in both cavities is equally favorable. We can also see in the Hamiltonian actually that there is a Fantini symmetry by rotating the light fields in the plane of the light fields and also rotating the momentum nodes in the plane of the momentum nodes. So this is cavity 1, cavity 2, and C1 plus minus and C2 plus minus are the red, so C1 are red nodes and C2 are the yellow nodes, so cavity 1, cavity 2. The associated effective potential now looks like that, so we have basically coupling to the two different flash fields and the overall factor here, so it means that if delta 1 equals delta 2, also these two prefactors are the same and we get a continuous symmetry in the system. In real space, this, as I mentioned here, right, it's just a different way of presenting it. All positions are identical, and therefore the crystal can form at any position. Now, what happens at different positions is that the coupling has different strengths in different cavities, and that means that the light field that builds up is also different. So it means just that the sum of the two light fields should be the same, no matter where I am, but depending on the position, the relative strength of the different light fields will change. And this is something we can measure in the experiment. So it's a very similar experiment to before. We ramp up the transverse pump, and we look at the photons in the cavities, and we see that, well, first, again, not so much happens, but then once I hit the critical point, I get light in both cavities, and I get all eight momentum modes here. And again, plus 2 H per K, plus 2 photon momenta, and minus 2 photon momenta, I get again the imposed letters, the letters of the transverse pump. We don't care about these two, the important ones are these four and these four. And again, we see them very sharply, that means that we still have superfluidity in the system, but yet we have now a continuous symmetry. So it's a continuous symmetry that is broken, and therefore we follow the system. The continuous symmetry can actually be mapped out by just performing this experiment many times, and as I mentioned, each time the relative strength of the two light fields should change. And what we can do is we can look if these ones actually lie in a circle, because our the effective potential here is formed from the two different light fields. They act as an order parameter. So that means that if I'm always on a circle here, I know, if each time I'm on a different point of the circle, I know that I actually have a true continuous symmetry that is broken here. And indeed, this is what we see here. So again, we can only measure the photon number and not the light field. Therefore, we only see the positive quadrant of the circle. But each time we perform the measurement, we measure the photon number in cavity 1 and cavity 2, and we can see that they distribute nicely in the circle. So basically, what we map out here is this positive product over here. And everything else is folded back to this positive product. Now, I can also ask the question, if I now go away from this high symmetry point, where the coupling to both cavities are the same, I should start to see a transition where only one cavity field is populated. And this is what we see here, so let me explain the axis here. Basically, on the x, so the left panel is the field in cavity 1, the right panel is the field in cavity 2. And we see that on this axis, we have the coupling to one cavity is increased, so the closer this number goes to 0, the higher is the coupling, and the same here. And this means that if I look here at for example, this column here, if I increase the coupling to cavity 1, well, at some point I see that in cavity 1, whereas cavity 2 remains empty. If I look on the other axis, I see nothing in cavity 1, and only at some point I see light in cavity 2. So this means the more strongly coupled cavity sees all the light, but there's no reason why I would see both cavities populated at the same time. Basically, everything I've shown you so far was work on this diagonal line, exactly here, so this is the same, right? So this line and this diagram line, exactly on this high symmetry situation. And as soon as I go away from that, well, I will always populate only the cavity that is more strongly coupled. So we are actually here on a very fine-tuned situation. In the two-dimensional phase diagram, this higher symmetry, this continuous symmetry, only exists on a line. So that's why it's called enhanced symmetry. And in general, the situation is called like two completely model parameters.
So in the two vertical and horizontal lines are the threshold, or?
These ones?
No, the square.
Oh, these ones are the theoretical predictions for the phase boundaries.
Ah.
Thanks. And now we can look at the momentum distribution of the different phases. So you can see here in this phase, you get actually these four momentum modes associated to self-organizing cavity 1, so this lattice supersolid with cavity 1. In the other phase, you see the lattice supersolid with cavity 2, only these four momentum modes. And if we are in the normal phase where we don't have organization to either of the two cavities, the only thing that remains are the momentum modes associated to the transverse complex, so no self-organization here. And these are the associated effective potentials. So here we see two minima on the axis of cavity 1, here two minima on the axis of cavity 2, and only exactly on the diagonal these two cancel in a way that get actually a continuous symmetry. So it's a very nice system where you can play around with all different parameters of this continuous symmetry, and you can also add any arbitrary term, basically, for example, linear terms of breaking the symmetry magnetic field, breaking it by hand, or adding cubic terms or other kind of terms here is actually very nicely feasible in the system. I will now add another term that I think is even more interesting I think I will probably have to skip this because I'm running out of time. This is just very briefly, so we can also look at the excitations and the dynamics of the system. But I think it's better if I skip this rather than going through fast through things. If anybody's interested, I'm happy to talk about this. The associated elementary excitations are Higgs and Boltzmann modes because on amplitude in the phase mode, you don't have continuous symmetry, and you can observe them here in real time. That's the idea. Now, the other crystal that I want to talk about is called intertwined order crystal, where now we have four different minima which the crystal can form. And the idea is now that you can interpret the two order parameters in cavity 1 and cavity 2 at two distinct ordering tendencies that now can be non-zero at the same time or also only one of the two. And this is something that, impermanence matter happens quite often, so that you have actually a phase that has two different orders simultaneously. For example, in group rates, where you would have antiferromagnetic order simultaneously with, for example, superfluid order, or where you would have a shard order. Also in multiferric systems, where you have a ferromagnetic and ferroelectric order at the same time. So it's very nice to study how these different ordering tendencies, how they influence each other. And that's something we can do here by adding this additional term, which couples the two different order parameters, right? Alpha 1 and alpha 2 are now coupled by an additional gamma 1, 2 constant. And actually, only if this is zero, we get this special situation which we were talking about so far. As soon as I would add this here with a non-zero value, well, either they repel each other, so they can't coexist. This means that the minima of the effective potential are lying on the axis of alpha 1 or alpha 2. That means I only have either alpha 1 non-zero or alpha 2 non-zero, but never both at the same time. And if gamma 1 2 is larger than zero, then the minima lie on the diagonals and the anti-diagonals. That means I will always have both parameters present at the same time, but never only one of the two. And we can set the situation now, I can also write an effective interaction now between the atoms, and we can see now that there are actually four different minima per wavelength because of this additional coupling term. Basically, this means that I have these ones are so strong that I get an effective potential long direction, which is four different minima that can now form either here with this lambda period, or here, or here, or here. So there are four different ways that this crystal can form. We can tune this by going a bit closer to the atomic resonance. It turns out that that this enhances this factor. Before it was basically zero, it was far beyond any other scale. And now, by going a bit closer to the atomic resonance, the scattering between the two different cavity modes gets enhanced. And this is sufficient to add this additional term. The phase program that I've shown you before changes now. So you see there's quite a significant region where it overlaps. So as soon as the coupling to both cavities is only similar, not identical, but only similar, we get a region where we get both light in cavity 1 and in cavity 2. And now we can just extract the phase boundaries here, and we can look at this at different coupling strengths. So we tune our gamma 1, 2 to larger values. And you see that now this region gets enhanced, and we can actually make it even so large that it covers almost the entire phase diagram. And this means that basically the critical point of one order is reduced compared to the non-coupled one. So if I would go along this direction here, well, it's actually I can have cavity 2 populated here, although I'm not in the region where I usually would have cavity 2 populated. So I can change critical points of an order parameter where I don't even change the coupling to this order parameter. That's actually quite a nice idea to think of it. So yeah, we can also extract basically the size of these and therefore map out this phase diagram as a function of gamma 1, 2. Now, what's next? Well, I've shown you that we basically were able to change the symmetries of the crystals that we want that we're forming here. The next thing that I would also like to do is to actually enhance these kind of interactions even further and build, I mentioned this a bit at the beginning, build the, reconstruct in a bottom-up approach the interaction potential in reciprocal space. And there are very interesting phenomena that happen. One that's there's a pairing regime. If you tune the different interactions in a way that they just cancel, well, there's a pairing behavior. This actually maps very much to the time crystals or to the time crystals that have been observed already. It's very much the same physics. So there are limit cycles already similar. Another approach that we would like to pursue in the future is building in a microscope. So actually, everything I've shown you, so maybe you remember, this is the platform that I've shown you at the beginning. On top of that is actually a microscope, so we can see these structures, and we can also image locally where the atoms are and where they aren't. In principle, this is something that is going to be implemented in a moment, but in principle, it should work. And I think these are very exciting directions. And to go even further, even more complicated interactions, one has to maybe go to more complicated cavity setups. Two cavities are nice, but maybe one can add more, build more complex interaction potentials, and this is something that it also depends on input from maybe you. So this was a team that we were working with at ETH Zurich, this is Simon Esslinger, the professor, and then Tobias Lanners, the senior scientist, and I was working with two different PhD students, André Morales and
So I haven't understood what evidence you have that this is a super solid,
so,
rather than just a solid.
The fact that you see in time of flight in the interference pattern is actually a proof that there's a cloud of phase coherence. Because otherwise you would not see phase coherence. Otherwise you would not see these peaks. You would just see some blown up distribution. And therefore, what we basically do is a coherence measurement. If you let it expand and you see sharp interference maxima, that shows you that there was a phase coherence in the cloud before you release it.
So maybe just related to this, so in the time of flight measurements that you showed, the peaks are pretty big still, right? They're like on the order of h4, maybe half an h4k.
This is the final time of flight.
So this,
yeah. But if you compare it to what you would expect if it was not coherent, there's actually no comparison, so it would be much, much harder.
Okay, but it's not yet a measurement of the coherence length. So.
No, we didn't measure the coherence length there.
Is there any measurement that you can do directly without like turning off the trap?
To measure what?
Like, say, to measure whether you have a superfluid or not. Or is it possible that as soon as you turn off the trap, everything becomes again the superfluid phase and loses any information regarding the fact that it was a kind of periodic range?
Yeah, something which one can do is to, so the most, or one of the most direct proofs maybe is to measure the critical velocity in the system. So to introduce an object and move it around and check if there's no dissipation below a certain critical velocity. That would be like the Landau criterion for superfluid. This is something which would be possible with the microscope, where you can actually project a small laser beam and move it around, and that would be the object that moves around, basically. And that's a measurement we could do in the future. Yeah.
I have a question, Stefan. I knew about this old story that people thought that supersolid were disturbed and blah blah. Do you know what changes in terms of like what symmetries you're bringing between what you guys are doing and, say, for example, a lattice of vortices in the superfluid phase? It seems to me in that case you're breaking the U1. I mean, you have a superfluid.
So the question is that the vortex lattice is super solid.
Solid or not? Yeah, exactly. Is there any difference from what you guys are doing from the viewpoint of what symmetries you're breaking?
So there's not really an order parameter that's so clear to do that, right? It's a good question. If I can consider a vortex lattice as super solid, or
This is the whole thing that you rely on is on the fact that you have this phase coherence that is typical of the superfluid, and then you're breaking, say, for example, the spatial U1.
Vortex all can only enter one by one, right? It always enters from the edge inside, so it's basically not a symmetry breaking that happens here, but I mean it's a topological excitation, right?
Yeah, but you can have a lattice of them.
But also that is just many topological excitations.
Are you asking me if a type 2 superconductor is a super solid?
Yeah, but even just, I think, like, for example, vortex lattices were observed in U4, right? And you have this triangular lattice of vortices, which seems to me that does break translations, but it's somehow lying on a superfluid. So, but it's okay, it was just
here.
So I want to ask again about the critical point. So, for example, in your continuous symmetry case, do you expect to get...
One problem with that is it's basically something that... this kind of phase diagram would be a phase diagram which can only exist for superfluid, right? And a vortex that is cannot exist without being superfluid. So basically a phase diagram I would have here like temperature and here interaction strength or whatever we put here now, right? Some cupping parameter lambda. I would have down here, I would have a superfluid, and here I would have a fluid, and here I would have a supersolid or something. Right, but there would not be any solid basically in that system.
Yeah, I see.
It doesn't exclude this idea, but it's just a bit weird. For us, this actually looks like this. So there's also the normal solid, which you get if you heat up this whole thing, and then you don't see the momentum peaks anymore, but you see light in the cavity. These phase boundaries, they're not they're just lines, they're drawn lines, but they're very, very interesting, like beyond the field effects that like make things, whatever, just one remark to this question.
Sorry. So in the continuous, what you call the supersolid, do you expect to see the same critical exponents as the XY model, or because it's also a continuous symmetry, or do you think they're going to be different because translations are involved in some?
We see the same as an XY model, corrected by the dissipation of the cavity, which is not negligible anymore if you look at the critical dynamics. But
Any other question? Yes.
Is it possible to imagine measuring the spatial dependence of the light that escapes the cavity? So you're counting photons right now.
Yes, it's possible to imagine. Not just the current setup, but in principle one could do that. Yeah. And it becomes in particular more interesting if one involves higher order cavity modes, multiple cavity modes. There's a group at the moment at Stanford that works on that already, looking at the contribution of different cavity modes. But then that.